Hello and welcome to the BLB podcast. This is the fifth episode in a series where we talk about the short story form, the writing process, and how to get published. The BLB podcast is a new project from Brick Lane Bookshop. I'm Kate Ellis, and this is my co-host, Peter J. Coles.
Hello there.
Hi there. Today we are extremely excited and a little nervous to be welcoming Wendy Erskine to the show.
Yeah, so Wendy Erskine lives in Belfast. Her fiction and non-fiction have been published by Repeater, Dostoevsky Wannabe, Faber and Faber, Tangerine Press, No Alibi Press, and Rough Trade Books. Sweet Home, her first collection of stories, was shortlisted for the Edgehill Prize and the Republic of Consciousness Prize. It was longlisted for the Gordon Byrne Prize and won the 2020 Butler Literary Award. And we're mainly here to talk about her new book, Dance Move, published by Picador.
And today, Wendy Erskine is going to read from her story, Secrets Bonita, Beach Crystal, Cancun.
Secrets Bonita, Beach Crystal, Cancun. For the last 9 years, Linda and Ray have been having a takeaway together on a Friday night. Linda arrived at Ray's around 7:30, and after the first glass of wine, they put through their order, which was the same every time. Always using the one takeaway, they were familiar enough with the food to be able to discern different workers. They gave them names. Mr. Hot sprinkled chili flakes on everything, but Neatso wrapped up the boxes very precisely. There was one they called Olivia after a girl Ray knew at school who was the worst in the class at cookery. Got a burnt an ice cube, Ray said. Olivia from the takeaway was of the same ilk. Her ginger, sometimes an inch thick. The onions, almost quartered. The best, though, was the boss. Great balance of flavours with the boss, Ray always said. Great balance of flavours. The boss knew what she was doing. Ray lived by herself, and so did Linda, since Danny had gone to university. Introduced by a mutual friend years ago, there had only been two occasions when they encountered each other outside the confines of Ray's house. Once their initial meeting at the mutual friend's, when the Friday night arrangement was first suggested, and then at their mutual friend's wedding. At the wedding, Ray wore her usual trainers, except in black. Her one concession to the event was a gold brooch in the shape of an owl. Linda thought that people at the wedding probably presumed that they were partners. Somebody at their table even said, "You two should come round to ours sometime." Linda didn't say that really, they just had a takeaway together once a week. Ray worked as a paramedic. When you look down and see that you still have the brains of the man from the motorbike accident on the toe of your boot, well, that's when you know you are doing a serious job, she said. She came out with this kind of comment quite often. Considerations of the fragility of skulls or how muscle turns black and viscous when burnt. It meant that Linda didn't often dwell on the various crises at the printers where she worked, or anything else really. She didn't see blood rubbed down drains in the road. In the whole time they'd been meeting, she'd only ever uttered Richie's name a handful of times. She couldn't be sure that Ray would actually even remember it. One evening when Ray was round, Ray said that Linda should maybe make other plans for the next week because she wasn't going to be there. "What do you mean?" Linda asked. "I'm not going to be here. I'm meeting somebody." "What do you mean?" "What do you mean? What do you mean? I'm meeting somebody for a drink, not against the law. On a Friday night." "You'll find, Linda, that the town is full of people meeting up for a drink on a Friday night." Linda reached for another spoonful of the chicken dish. "Well, yeah," said Ray. "Going for a drink, nothing major, just going to see how it goes." "So it's that kind of a drink?" Linda said. "Drink's a drink, it's just for somebody I've been talking to online." That Ray talked to guys online seemed quite incredible. "You'll need to be careful, won't you?" Linda said. "Why's that?" Ray asked. "Do you never read the papers?" "Don't think I need to worry, Linda. I contacted him online, but I didn't meet him online. Knew him from years ago. We used to work together." "I thought you said that all the guys you work with are next to useless." "We're not going to be working on Friday night." "Well," Linda said, "just as long as you know what you're doing."
"I do."
"That's good then." Ray put her plate down. "Mike's like you," she said. "Divorced. Plenty of us around.
Plenty of you around making money for all the lawyers."
That was wonderful. Thank
that
you, Wendy.
That was very good.
I love the way you kind of, you make it more alive than even it is on the page. You
can just so much. Yeah, thank you.
You can visualize them just sitting around, waiting, picking at the curry.
It was such a pleasure because it seems you know your writing extremely well, and you know how it flows and how it works. And I think that was so good. That was really,
oh,
really
thank
good.
You so much. Thank you.
That was lovely.
And for listeners that haven't read the whole story yet, it's a good place to stop because it doesn't. At that stage, you don't know what the hell's going to happen next, and you would never ever guess. It kind of.
Yeah. I've hardly read this one at all, you know, and it's because the sort of different strands are very, they're very woven together. And so it's difficult to extract a section where it makes sense without people having had the whole, but that little bit, I think right at the beginning, it does it okay. So hopefully that will make sense.
Maybe that's a good first question that we can ask then, because that was something we both were thinking about when reading your pieces, is that I think in another article as well, someone mentioned that your pieces sort of pivot all of a sudden, often in your writing. And I was wondering if that's something that you're consciously doing or if it's something that just sort of comes naturally to your writing.
Pivot? Whenever you say pivot, do you mean it sort of changes direction? Or?
Yeah. So I think a lot of the stories, you think it's going to go one way or you have an idea about something and then suddenly there's a massive twist. For instance, this is where I can't remember the names of them. The one with the man and he's going to the film festival. What's that?
Oh,
one?
Yeah. Gloria and Max.
Gloria and Max. Yeah. Oh, Gloria and Max. I was gobsmacked because you just don't expect it to happen and then it happens, and well, you have to read the story I think to find out. I don't want to spoil it, but is this something you're consciously doing, this sort of sudden change of gear and pace?
Well, I suppose, you know, it's not one of those things I would say that I'm kind of thinking I want to have twists in these stories, in that very, you know, I suppose it is a very short story type thing, a short story of a very particular type, that there's a type of that there's a twist at some point. It's not really that it's very, very conscious and very, very deliberate. It's just something that happens. I mean, to be honest, I'm driven so much more by just characters and how the characters are developing and how the relationship between the characters is creating kind of a meaning or is creating a kind of a particular type of a feeling. So it's that, I suppose, that drives it, rather than thinking of anything in terms of plot that's going to constitute a twist. But I think if you pay enough attention to the characters, those things just happen almost without you realizing.
I think so. It's I think another way you could think about it is that your stories sort of often feel like they're gaining an extra layer halfway through, as in the sort of another part of the character is revealed later on.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what I'm trying to do as well with that, Kate, is that idea of those layers, it's kind of like an accretion of sort of like past and present and everything moving to kind of complicate and to kind of deepen the people that are involved in the story. And so I suppose that's why sometimes people say, oh, it flits a lot, it moves between past and present, and you know, I think it does, but it's kind of the idea that the identity of these people and who they are is shaped by all of these past experiences that kind of coexist with how they are now. So like a word I just really hate is backstory, because you know, it's as if you have just this little glimpse of the past in order to facilitate, you know, something that's happening in the present, and it's just like a kind of a an adjunct, or it's just a kind of a filler. And for me the past is as important as the present, really. And sometimes, in fact, in some of the stories, it's actually more important than the present, that the present is a kind of a top line of maybe not much happening, whereas the past relationship between the people is where the real interest is, you know.
That makes sense. When your characters think about their past, it never feels like backstory. It feels like a memory for them that is very present in their current lives. Mm-hmm. Like the sort of when Mrs. D'Alessandro disappears to the tanning shop in the sort of back streets of Belfast, mm-hmm. and she has a fantasy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like that's a backstory. It feels like that it's sort of very important for her still. And yeah. She's sort of escaping into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like a word sometimes as well people have used that I think is just not really terribly appropriate is reverie. I don't think it's reverie at all. Reverie to me just seems so sort of kind of dreamy and so kind of almost inconsequential. And so reverie just isn't it at all. You know, it's the way whenever, even as we're talking now, you know, people are running concurrently are projections to the future. You could be thinking what you're going to be doing later on this evening. You're also thinking as well about, you know, maybe whenever you read some of these stories, particular times, whenever, you know, you might have read one of the stories we're talking about, all of that happens concurrently. And so it's not some sort of, you know, dreamy sort of self-conscious thing like that at all, really, that the past is informing the present in a really significant way.
I think it's so fascinating that you have your present informing the past as well, it seems like. That everything is mediated through... it says like everything is present, even the past, and everything is being mediated through the actions that are happening. I was rereading your work today and I read Dance Move with the title piece.
Yeah.
And I'd read it once, but I read it again in a cafe today. And I was nearly in tears. I really was, because I was thinking about the way that Kate, where you don't really name the tragedy or the trauma that she's gone through. Well, you do because of, you know, there's the brother has been injured, but yeah. For her, it seems almost nameless as well. And I thought that was so powerful. And then you see this sort of like repetition of trauma that's now going on to her daughter, that the daughter is probably going to be just as traumatized by everything. Is that something you're sort of working towards in your novels as well, this sort of trauma that builds on trauma that builds on trauma that builds on trauma, and it sort of gets passed down generationally?
Yeah, you know, I suppose I am, and a lot of it, as you say, it's not anything that's ever overtly expressed or even massively acknowledged by a lot of the characters. You know, it's there, but it's not something that's ever even named, you know. But I suppose one of the things I think as well about a short story collection is that in reality what you end up having is about, you know, say in a collection like this, 11 stories, whatever, you end up having about 24 central characters. And so in terms of themes and ideas, it can kind of sustain a lot of different interpretations, if you know what I mean. So I think you're absolutely right, the whole trauma idea, but also as well, just because of the nature of the number of characters involved and the number of things that happen, you know, there's probably other things too.
I think there are so many themes and so many characters, yeah. And they're all kind of, I think one of the things I like about your work is that all of the characters are treated with sort of equal attention. Like all of them have complicated lives and brains and memories. Something about the lack of hierarchy that appears and the sort of invisibility of judgment in the stories. Mm-hmm. And kind of whether the character is bad or good, or, I mean, they're never that binary, but you kind of zoom in on their mental state.
I think we were saying when we were having a discussion about it, we were saying about kindness. It seems that you treat all your characters with a lot of kindness, which I find just remarkable. I think it was, yeah, some of the earlier stories that I read, I was just like, yeah, there's so much like empathy, I feel like, you're giving the characters, because even the sort of bad ones have redeeming qualities. Even the bad ones sort of not every, they're just human, I guess. You're writing very, very human stories.
Well, that's lovely to hear. That, you know, that's really lovely to hear, Peter. You know, I think it's good if it comes across that way. Basically, I'm not interested in writing some sort of, you know, very didactic type of text where I'm encouraging people to make very particular judgments on individuals. You know, it is just, as you say, trying to write complex, nuanced characters. And that's going to mean that somebody that is, you know, basically quite a sympathetic character is also going to be deeply unattractive at times, you know. So say, for example, in Golem, there's a woman who is, I think, in some ways quite funny, quite likable individual. But then whenever her sister tells her about sexual assault, her attitude is totally unsympathetic, you know. You could say it's quite awful in some ways, but at the same time, it makes sense within the context of their relationship. So yeah, I'm not trying to be too judgmental. But again, that kind of, as well though, Peter, kind of relies on you having an intelligent reader, in the sense that, you know, say a character makes a remark that is, you know, offensive or racist or whatever, there's not going to be some sort of authorial intrusion from me going, you know, and that was appalling or whatever. You know, I kind of am trusting people to be able to, you know, make their judgments on these characters without me having to, you know, in this intrusive way, spell it out to them in terms of what they should think. And then as well, some people do like you to take a hard line on characters. Some people would like it. I suppose you would say some readers might like it if some people were judged more harshly. They like it when there's that kind of authorial intrusion and people are called out for their behavior such, but that's just not really the way I want to work. And if the way I work comes across as kind, well, I'm delighted by that. Thank you.
That definitely does. I would say that the only authorial intrusion I noticed was when you inserted yourself into the stories, which I thought was quite playful.
Yeah. It was. Yeah, you know. Do you know what? It was kind of. I just kind of thought, right, how are these two women? So I was wanting these two women to kind of, how am I going to get these two people together? Where could they have met in a way that doesn't seem totally, totally contrived? And for some reason, I just thought my own book launch of there were just so many different people there from different walks of life. And I thought, yeah, let's use that. And I kind of thought, well, if I'm going to put myself into the book, I'm certainly not putting myself in as this like amazing character. So I think I come across in it as a bit of a nitwit, you know, a bit of a...
The you in the book is a little bit oblivious, I would say.
yeah, a bit oblivious, yeah, a bit obsessed with short stories and, you know, my own career and so on. Yeah, so... Yeah.
It's nice to see there for some reason. It was just like, oh, hello. It's the author popping in to say hello. It was good. I really liked it.
It's like when a director makes a cameo.
Yeah.
It weirdly made the stories even more real for some reason as well. Like, you know, you're here now. The author's here now. So therefore, all the other stories, the author was kind of there or knew about these people or knew them somehow. So it kind of like brings it all together, maybe. I'm not sure. But yeah. But Memento Mori is a really good example of what we were just talking about, of this, you know, this woman having to face the death of her partner while having to deal with this crowd of mourners who were dealing with this woman's death and the sort of, what was it, a memorial that was put outside her house. Like, when I read your stories, I'm asking the question, how do you come to that point? Like, how do you get there in your mind? Is it just like, you're just like, oh, this is naturally where this goes? This is naturally where the stories go? Or like, where do your ideas come from? I think that's the better way to ask this question.
I suppose, right, the idea for that one came from just walking past one of those roadside memorials for somebody. And it was actually in a fairly residential area. And I remember just thinking, you know, this is so sad, so touching. And then I thought, hold on a minute, how would you feel if that was what you had to pass every single time you went into your house? You know, how, and I kind of, like, I'm interested in that type of art as well. I'm interested in the sort of like that kind of, you know, memento mori, contemptus mundi tradition of art and all of that. And I kind of thought, what would it be like though to have to see that outside your house every single day? And I suppose it just came from that. I sort of thought, right, okay, so let's have someone who's already trying to cope with some sort of death, also then having this and trying to cope with it in a very subdued way and in a very kind of contained way and dignified, even, you could say. What's that like when that comes up against a much more showy sort of meretricious way of dealing with death? So yeah, that was basically it.
The BLB podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, they're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount off any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org.
You find that a lot of your stories come from just like observing the world and then just imagining what's next.
Yes, totally. It'll come from maybe some, and they'll all work quite differently, you know, and normally there'll be some sort of impetus, maybe something that I've seen or maybe something that I've heard, or just some little snippet And that'll give me probably an idea for a character, I would say, or a couple of characters, and then it'll develop from there. The way I normally work is that I'll have this idea and maybe some characters, and I'll write a first draft, and I'll write the first draft with really no restrictions whatsoever. And it's lovely at that point because I'm just writing, and maybe I'm changing point of view through it all over the place. Maybe I'm changing characters' names. They're not static at all. I'm still trying to get to know them, so the whole thing's really fluid. And I don't really know what's happening. I'm just going whatever way. And then what happens is I have to read it really carefully. And I might write for a 6,000 word story. I might write double or triple that or whatever. And then I have to look at it in a really cool way, in a really clinical way, and think what's happening here? What's of interest? You know, and sometimes it'll be that some of those characters, Peter, that I thought were so central are actually more peripheral, and something that is happening on the sidelines is actually the really interesting thing, and I'll need to bring that to the fore. So that's normally the way it works for me.
How do you get yourself to the state of seeing your own work in a cool way? Like, that's kind of, a lot of writers find it hard to detach and edit. Do you have a kind of tactic, or is it just time?
So I would normally finish that long first draft, and then I'd normally leave it for a couple of days, and then just sit. I would normally print it off as well. Like, this house here will be full of these first drafts, you know, under the bath, at all sorts of places where I've been reading them. I'll normally print it off if we've got ink. Quite often we don't. I'll print it off, and sometimes just moving it to actual print just gives me again a bit of distance on it. And it's kind of a lot of the time simplifying things down. And it's also as well cutting myself out of it in a way, in the sense that I'm often trying to remove the things that I think are clever, you know, because they don't really serve the story terribly at times. And it's just trying to read in quite a brutal and an objective way. And sometimes it's embarrassing to read things that I've written because they're so awful. And other times it can be quite, think, oh, that little bit there is quite interesting, or that person makes a brief appearance, that there's something about that that I think is worth exploring, you know.
They don't come out perfectly formed.
They sure do. They certainly do. They certainly do not. They certainly don't, no.
That's lovely to hear.
They feel so perfectly formed, and it's difficult to not believe that, I think.
That's okay. No, there's a lot of work. A lot of work goes into them. Yeah, for sure.
How long were you writing Dance Move for?
One of those stories in Dance Move Cell was written round about the time of Sweet Home, actually. And I didn't end up putting it in the collection because I kind of thought, I wonder if that's actually really a novel, because it was kind of complicated, quite a lot of characters, a long period of time as well. Action takes place over a long period of time. And I thought, I wonder if I should work on that, and maybe that could be a novel. But then I just thought, no, you know what? I've already told it, it's a short story. It's fine. It works as a short story. Let's leave it. So there was that one, and there was another one that had been on the radio, but the rest of it then would have been written from about 2000 and sort of like late 2019 to sort of like 2021 or so. That would have been about a year, but yearish, year and a half maybe. Not as quick as, I don't think it was as quick as Sweet Home. Sweet Home, I was super disciplined. I wrote a story a month for 15 months. This was not quite like that, but wasn't too bad.
Can we ask what you're working on now? Or is that a secret?
No, it's not real. So I've got a couple of things that I'm actually working on another short story at present. So I've got a short story to write for a magazine, and quite enjoying doing that because it's at that stage. It's at that stage, Kate, where I'm just writing that big long first draft. So that's fun, and I'm not having to think too critically about anything. But beyond that, and also as well working on a book to do with an edit in a book to do with art, but that other people have made contributions. So it's art in the home, and the home is art. So that's quite an interesting thing I've been working on. But yeah, I'm definitely going to give something longer a go. We'll see how that works.
That was one of my questions. I was wondering, because it's a wonderful thing to have published two short story collections, mm-hmm. and often great short story writers get pressured into working on a novel. Mm-hmm. Do you feel a pressure, or is it just something that you feel like doing now?
You know, nobody's ever pressurized me whatsoever. You know, so after the first short story collection, I didn't really know what to do. And I kind of thought, well, what is it I enjoy doing? And I thought, well, writing short stories. So I just did another collection. And I suppose I haven't really ever, in terms of writing, I haven't ever really worked with any great sense of strategy or plan or even any idea of a career. You know, it's just kind of been, you know, what do you like doing? Well, then do that, you know. Or if people have asked me to do things, it's always just been, does that sound like an interesting sort of project? Do those seem like nice people? Oh, well, then do that. So there was no expectation for a novel, really. At all. But sometimes I kind of think that I would like to dwell in the worlds of the stories for a longer duration. That there's sometimes where I sort of think to myself when I'm in the midst of it, I like these people. I find this interesting. I feel that I'd like to work on this, or I'd like to be in this world for a number of months. And so I'll maybe give that a go. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it would work out or not. I don't know if it's in talent, but I don't know if what I've developed a kind of an ability to do is something that's kind of elliptical and is kind of, there's lots of holes. There's lots of things that allow readers to kind of insert their own ideas and allow them to, in a sense, are kind of co-opted into creating meaning. So I suppose the endings as well of short stories I really like, in the sense that they rely a lot of the time on the idea of future time and a reader thinking about what's going to happen beyond that final full stop. So I kind of know a way of working like that. And I don't know if I tried to do something like that was longer, like a novel, if I would be any good at doing it, but I'll give it a go.
Could you sort of elaborate on your endings more? Because they are fascinating. They're so, so, so intriguing. I think Dance Move is one that stands out to me. I just, because I love that story so much. And I read it a couple of times. But just that ending of her not being able to move, but giving, because I feel like you always give the reader the ability to pick a path, basically. How would you like the story to end? Mm-hmm. Is that something you're doing, or is that, or
yeah, that's totally, that's, you, yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. You know, I just don't like, I don't like stories really where the ending is absolutely shut down. I do sometimes write ones like that, but they're not my favorite sort of stories. So those sorts of endings where all the meaning of the whole story resides in the final couple of paragraphs, I'm not really into that idea. So I kind of like it where it's more tentative, and there's a range of possibilities. And it's up to the reader really to think what they find most satisfying. Like, remember I did a thing in a bookshop in Edinburgh, and it was one of the stories from the previous collection, one called The Soul Has No Skin. It was a really lovely woman that worked in the bookshop, and she said to me, she said, just tell me, is Barry okay? And Barry was the central character, and she goes, is Barry okay? Is he okay? And I just thought that you cannot get a higher compliment about your writing than that. That somebody would take a fake person, a character, a construct, whatever you want to say, and we kind of want reassurance that this non-person is all right. And I thought it was brilliant. So yeah,
but that's a compliment.
It's a real compliment.
When you were talking about that, I was worrying about Gillian and whether she's going to be okay. Yeah. The one in Memento Mori.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? What do you think? Do you think she's going to be okay, Kip?
I think she's going to continue along her quiet life, but I doubt that she'll find the joyful companionship she found with Tracy again. Maybe she won't find that kind of love again.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say so. I would say so.
Yeah.
I can remember. Sorry there.
No, I was gonna gush about Dance Move again, but I think one of the reasons it resonates so much, because I'm a new father, my son's only two. And mm-hmm. It was everything that Kate does in that story is everything I don't want to do, but fear I'm going to do. And then that ability of her to choose at the very end whether she dances or not. It was like, oh, please dance, just go dance with your daughter, please, you know, just do it, please, because I want to be the father that dances there. I don't want to be the father that doesn't dance there and stands and gets angry. And it worries me. And I think I put myself so much into the character in that moment. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. And like Stacey, the girl that she's kind of demonized and maybe envied, she's the lovely one at the end, in the little space and saying, thank you. Thank you so much.
It's nice talking to you about your characters. And it's like we all have our own ideas of these people in our heads. I read that you kind of think about the characters in a story kind of before you start writing anything.
I do, right? Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to do is, and it always sounds totally ridiculous, and it sounds as though you're trying to be sort of like Mystic Meg about it all, that these people are revealing themselves. And, you know, it's not that. But before I normally put pen to paper, I just kind of think about them. Or not all of the time, but I think about them and, you know, imagine sort of having a conversation with them, just trying to get them. So I get to know them. So I'm getting a sense, a sort of clear sense of what they're like. So at present, the story that I'm trying to write at present is about a man who gets a phone call to say that his father, this woman thinks that his father is being ripped off by these guys that are, you know, doing odd jobs and, you know, charging him a fortune, you know, painting the front door, 500 quid for giving him a lift into town, you know, 50 quid, all the rest of it. But the man's so lonely, he's almost willingly paying for the company, you know, and he's like, okay, it's a bit steep, but he likes having these guys around. And I'm just trying to think, and just trying to get into the mindset of this man and who he is and why he feels like this. And so I'll just spend a few weeks without really writing too much, thinking about, you know, why certain people feel this way. And, you know, just trying to, you know, even beyond the actual subject matter of the story, try to think about this character and what might have happened to them, you know, what sort of clothes they would wear, all the rest of it, even though those are details that are probably never going to make it to the story. You know, what sort of trousers a person wears doesn't make any odds, but it'll all be stuff that I'll be thinking about.
Do any of your characters, like, I guess I think of the word haunt. Do they anything haunt you? Are the characters that you still think about, that you wrote years ago, that you still think about? I've never heard anyone sort of spend so much time and sort of mental energy enjoying their characters that's not maybe in a novel, maybe. But
I think, you know, one of the characters, that's the story Secrets Bonita Beach, right? One of the characters that I really return to over and over is that character Richie from Secrets Bonita Beach, who is, in a sense, he's not even there ever in the present. So in terms of that sort of top line of the story of the two women and meeting and having the takeaway and so on, Richie's in the past. Richie's never existing in the present in that story, but he haunts the entire story. And he's just a sort of, you know, the sort of old mod, you know, ex-taxi driver who's had this dreadful, terrible childhood. I just find him a really haunting character. And, you know, you were saying earlier about the sort of initial impetus for stories. For that one, it was so clear to me. I imagined this kind of like TV room in the place where Richie lived as a kid, and just imagined this boy watching this amazing nature scene on the TV and being so, you know, enchanted and transpired, whatever, and the others just appalled to see this kid so soft and vulnerable, loving this nature scene, and just they're just thinking, oh my, please don't be like that, don't be like that, you know, it's just going to make life. And for some reason, that scene just came to me, and so the whole story really kind of blossomed, or, you know, took shape from that particular scene. So yeah, I really like him as a character because he exists just entirely in the margins.
You have a lot of printed pages of a first draft with Richie.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So Richie, you know, That's the way it works. And I suppose it's that idea, you know, it's that idea, Kate, that nobody in life thinks they're a minor character. You know, nobody's going to go through their life thinking, well, I'm you know, one of the bit innkeeper or, you know, shepherd free or whatever. No, nobody ever thinks that about themselves. They think that they're central. And I kind of think it, with these stories, that if you've kind of already thought about everybody and you've thought about, you've made these people complex, that even if they're reduced, then even if they do, they're like Richie, and then they're just on the margins, because they've already existed in a much more developed form. What then does make it to the final story is hopefully, not always, but hopefully more complex than just a kind of a cutout, you know, cipher or whatever.
I think I read in your Irish Times interview that you said you take writing very seriously. And yeah, it really sounds like you do. It sounds like you take it so seriously. And I think that's just, it's marvelous. And you can tell it pays off. It pays off on the page. How do you keep that discipline, do you think?
Well, I can't write. I do take it really, really seriously. But at the same time, I kind of also, Peter, would have to say, don't take it seriously at all.
Okay.
You know, in the sense that at the end of the day, what you're doing, you're making up stories about fake people, you're making up stories about people that don't exist. And also as well, a lot of people that I care about deeply are of no interest in reading whatsoever. So I don't sort of subscribe to that sort of liberal humanist thing that it's just transformative for absolutely everybody. To me, it's, you like it. For me, it's so important. It's major. I take it really seriously. For other people, it's not the thing, and they get their kicks going on walks through forests or doing all sorts of stuff that I just wouldn't be interested in doing. I just think that if you want to do something, then it's worth trying to do it really well. It's worth trying to do it as well as you can possibly do it, and this is just my way of working on it. As far as I can see, there's just not really any shortcuts to it. And I suppose that I never want anybody to draw any kind of sort of precepts or whatever from how I work, because this is particularly how I work. And there might be people that could write fantastic stories and do them so quickly and not do all the stuff that I do. And they're brilliant, you know, but this is just the way I do it. You know, if I want them to work in the way that I hope they're going to work, it does need me to work in quite a serious and purposeful and fairly laborious way. Sometimes I wish it wasn't like that, but that is how it is.
Maybe the final question before we run out of time is what we ask everyone, is what are you reading? What are you reading now? And is there anything that you always go back to?
Well, yes. Yeah, so a book that I always go back to that I would probably read every single year is Good Behaviour by Molly Keane. And it's like a big house novel, and it's written first person, unreliable narrator, and I just find it so funny. The woman's a monster, but the way it's written, you end up just being totally on her side, even though she's just such an awful character, vulnerable too, but an awful character in some ways. I just love Seven Steeples by Sarah Baum. I thought it was an amazing and beautiful book, absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Did an event at the weekend with Jem Calder, who I know that you were.
Yeah,
speaking
we talked to him the other week.
Yeah, you talked to him the other week. Really, I thought he was brilliant. Thought the book was brilliant, and thought the way he read was brilliant. So that was great. I think there's so many great short story collections at present. Really just started this one, Ghost Signs and Poverty in the Pandemic by Stu Hennigan. Absolutely excellent so far. So yeah, I try and read as much as I can, but I read quite quickly and not super carefully at times, you know. I
skip. Get through. Yeah. Try and get as much as possible. Yeah. Well, I think that's it. I think we're going to wrap up the podcast here. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Really, really fascinating. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
It has been my total pleasure to get to chat to you. Thank you so much for having me along. Totally appreciate it.
An great. Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Wendy. I could have listened to you talking for a long, long time.
So thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. It was produced and edited by Kate Ellis and Peter J. Coles, and music was by Andrew Everett. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at bricklanebookshop.org or search Brick Lane Bookshop wherever you find podcasts.